Hello, and welcome to the Retroactive Podcast. I am your host, Fred Rojas. For this third episode, we're going to branch off a little bit, and admittedly, it's because I haven't quite finished up my original plans for episode 3, which is the PC Engine CD Exposé Part 1, and we're instead going to switch to something I really like, which is technical talk. Now, before everyone's eyes glaze over, and before you stop the show just yet, I want to stress that this is to ideally demystify tech. And there are a lot of great resources for it. So for the longest time, I never did an episode like this. I think I did one way back when on Gaming History 101 when I did that strain. But it was all discombobulated and I didn't really have it clear in my head. And this is a problem I had, and I think a lot of retro people have, which is you're trying to describe something you don't quite understand. But then when you go to the source and try to understand something, you get way more than you bargained for, and it might be a little over your head. So this is, of sorts, a primer. Its goal is to run the basics by you, and then hopefully you can take that information. If you want to dig deeper, you can, but otherwise, when you hear people talk about things like machine language or assembly language or machine code, or when you hear people talk about 240p, you can be like, oh, I get the concept of that. I don't really need to dig into it because I'm not going to build my own game. And so that's what this episode is about. This is about starting pretty basic. I think I'm going to do more of these, but to put it into an overall thesis, we're going to start with the 8-bit consoles, and that's specifically the, I don't know what generation, I don't even care. And I do believe the Atari 2600 /VCS is considered an 8-bit console, as was the ColecoVision. Actually, the ColecoVision might have been 16-bit console. There were these pre-NES consoles in the West, and I'm actually not going to talk about those yet. I'm not qualified to talk about them, and I don't know enough about them, but my understanding was that the processors that ran them were either 8-bit, and I believe with the ColecoVision it was 16-bit. So we're actually going to start with North America, mid-80s, NES, Sega Master System, and then eventually TurboGrafx-16. And we're going to focus in on those today and some of the questions and concepts surrounding their technology. And real quick before we kick it off, I just want to say to people, this is going to be a little less edited than my previous show with Dead Space and my future show with Exposés, because this is more of just like a conversational piece, a fireside chat, if you will. And secondarily, its goal is to build on itself, right? We start with simple concepts that I can reference later, and then we can move forward. But what I'm learning with a lot of what I want to cover in the future, I want to talk about the technology behind it a little bit, and I don't want to waste time. Waste is the wrong word. I don't want to spend time on that episode digging into it, and especially if people just really aren't interested in it, and I know there's plenty of you out there, then it just allows you to skip ahead or listen in. So I don't know exactly how long this episode's going to be, but anyone who's watching it will probably know at the forefront. So let's start off with, why am I even doing this? I think we have this tendency to love and appreciate technology nowadays, especially video games, without understanding what drives them. And I don't mean at an advanced level. I'm talking about when people make blanket statements like, oh, this isn't in HDR, but they don't even know what the concept of HDR is. Or, oh, I think 30 frames a second or 60 frames a second or 120 frames a second is really important, but they don't even know what that really means. They don't know what frame pacing is, frame times, audio latency, what is ambient occlusion, what is, you know, all these different concepts. And I've banged this drum enough where I'm just like, okay, so let's talk about it and let's kind of, like I said, demystify what you do and do not know about the technology you run. So, circling back, we have in 1983, we have Nintendo jumping into the console market. Now, previous to this, they had done a lot of businesses. If you don't know the history of Nintendo, it's a different story. David Sheff's book is an incredible resource, which is like how Nintendo, you know, took over the world or whatever. Look up David Sheff, his book. It's great. But you'll find that Nintendo dabbled in a lot of businesses. They started in Hanafuda cards. Later on, they would do, I believe they did fitness clubs. They definitely did love hotels. And then they did arcade games. And arcade games is where they saw outside of Japan's success, right? And you're talking arcade games such as Radar Scope, and then later on Donkey Kong and Popeye, and then it goes from there. And so they decided they wanted to get into the console market. And the way they were going to do this was with this computer pitch. And you'll find this time and time again in Japan, where you sell off a console as like a simplified or family-oriented or non-technical person's gateway into the magic of the personal computer or PC. And so they call their system the Family Computer, or for short, Famicom. And if you've never seen it, it looks like a peppermint swirl. It's hilarious. It's white with red trim. The controllers are built into the system. You can't even unplug them, although there were expansion ports you could plug separate controllers into it. And it only had RF out. I'll get to video later in this show, but it only did radio frequency out. So if you've never seen it before, it's a single port on the system that screws into the back of any commercial television that allows you to get an audio video signal through radio frequency. And they bring this out in 1983 in Japan, and then it does very well, and they decide to export it to America, where their arcade business is starting to thrive. So just to give key figures in case I bring them up, you've got Hiroshi Yamauchi, who is in charge of Nintendo in Japan. He's a very assertive, aggressive man. People make lots of jokes about him, but he was very much, even though he might not have been a very pleasant person to be around at times, he was very much a very savvy business person. And he does something very common in Japan, which is his daughter's husband, Minoru Arakawa, is put in charge of Nintendo in America. And they're out in, I believe, Washington State at this time, and they're doing their thing out there. And they want to bring this to America as the Nintendo Entertainment System. And they were aware that this was kind of a gamble because, you know, people talk about the video game crash, and while it's easy to see from a business ledger perspective how that happens and how manufacturing stops and everything falls apart and Atari collapses in on itself, from a video game perspective, if you're just in America, it's not necessarily so cut and dry, because Atari still remains on the shelves up to and including the time where the NES comes out. Arcade games are prevalent all over the place, and arcades do exist. You've got computers, microcomputers like the Commodore 64 and the Atari 400, 800 series, and various others still continuing to exist. So video games are not gone like the crash of 84 would have you believe, but from a manufacturing and business perspective, it is definitely a thing where they just gave up on it. Another thing that I think is important to mention when you look at these items is the fact that in Japan, it's easier to sell things to adults as well as children, that in America, and I would say North America, the West, are seen as purely marketed towards children. An example, two easy examples of this is animated shows known as anime in Japan, or anime. And over here in America, they would simply be called cartoons. And even though adults could enjoy them, they were marketed for and built for children. The same is true of video games. The NES, while it could be enjoyed by adults, and many did, it was marketed for and sold to children. That is the only market. If an adult is going in there looking for it, it's for their kid. The commercials were made for it. The marketing was made for it. The cartoons that came from it were made for it. And ultimately, it was designed. It was even, you couldn't buy most video game consoles outside of a toy store. So you get this first 8-bit console. And let's get into kind of what that means. So what does 8-bit mean? Well, frankly, it's simplified to, it's what the processor does. And if you're not familiar with this, most video game consoles and computers nowadays will have multiple processors. You will have a CPU, a central processing unit, which handles, let's say, the operations of the system. Then you've got a GPU, or a graphics processing unit. Back in the day, these were better known by Nintendo as PPU, picture processing unit, and then VDP. And I do forget what VDP stands for, but obviously V is video. And so it was this separation of, you've got a processor that's handling the operations, you've got a video processor that's handling what you see on the screen, and then you put them together, and they also have to take in the interactions from the controller. You put them all together, and they show up on your screen as exported out. And there's a lot more to that. We'll get to the video signal later in the show, but That's in essence what it is. So from a certain standpoint, the old, age-old concept of the bigger the bits, the better, it is true. An 8-bit CPU is only capable of 8-bit processes. A 16-bit CPU is capable of 16-bit processes. And from my limited understanding, it's not as simple as just doubling up. So people would say things like, oh, well, the Super Nintendo is twice as powerful as the NES. That's, I don't believe, true. From my understanding, it can be exponential growth, right? You have different combinations. You know, from what I understand from 8-bit, you have up to 255 characters you can use. But then when you get to 16-bit, you have just an exponential larger number. I want to say it's like 32,000 or something different characters you can use. But again, we're delving into territory that's out of my realm of expertise. And so you do have an 8-bit processor, and, you know, as we build up, yes, they can do more. But one thing I want to stress and that we need to look at when we're looking at old games is being stronger isn't enough, because it's what the programmers do with it that really defines how those extra bits can be utilized. It's simply a computer that says, I have a bandwidth to do more. But what do you do with all of that? And that's where you can see major leaps forward. You take, let's say, Super Mario Brothers versus Super Mario World. And again, I like this idea where you don't have to know technicalities to understand that it is doing exponentially more things. You know, Super Mario World is doing exponentially more things than Super Mario Brothers. But if you get talented enough programmers, that gap on the same hardware can start to bridge, where you start looking at things like, well, let's really break it down and let's look at Kirby's Adventure on the NES, a late, almost mid-90s game, and then like an early, you know, side-scrolling game such as, I don't know, let's just say ActRaiser. ActRaiser is doing more than just that, but think of just the side-scrolling levels. Even though the graphics look better, there's not a whole lot of difference between what is going on there, right? So you can see that with newer techniques, you can do things never thought of before on the old system just before you harbor in the new system. And it's because familiarity with it, right? Another thing you see is one that we'll get to later is when you get to the 32-bit era, everything goes from 2D to 3D. Well, then all of a sudden you see this step back where the games aren't doing as critical things because now they're having to use a lot of their operations to render 3D space and do all the things that have to go with that, such as collision detection and various other higher end camera movement, right? These are things you never had to worry about in the 2D space. So that's where you get these, what I like to think of as like diminishing returns, where as you grow the power, you have to do more with it. Like people want to step outside the box of what was done. And so, yeah, nowadays, if you made just a 2D side-scrolling game, and many indie developers do, you have more than enough power with modern-day hardware. But it's once you start trying to do something new that suddenly you can see the gameplay step back. Anyway, with this in mind, let's talk about the chips. So really, there were only two main 8-bit processors on the market. You've got the Intel 8080 and the Motorola 6800. Those are your big dogs. Now, before you write the YouTube comments and before you get, you know, into all the, oh, but Fred, you're wrong. Yes, I know there are other microprocessors. In fact, these consoles only used alternatives. So we'll get to them in a minute. But I just want people to know, it's very easy in 2023 to visualize, oh, there's two competitors, right? And it's even Intel versus someone else. So just like Intel takes on AMD today, it was Intel versus Motorola. And they used different, there were just different factors to each of them. I won't get into the details, but those were the two main chips that were out there doing 8-bit microprocessing. And out of those, there were offshoots, kind of like, think of like as clones, but like third-party clones with, you know, the same operational, with caveats, standpoints. And so one of those was the Z80, the Zilog Z80, or the Z80, as it was more used in microcomputers and our friends across the pond in Europe, way more familiar with it. But the Z80 processor was, simply put, a processor that took what the Intel 8080 did and modified it and used it for its own gains. And it, there must be something about it that is popular because it was used in the Sega Master System and later in the Game Boy and in tons of microcomputers. So maybe it was cost effective. That's usually the case. And then the other one you've got is this offshoot of the Motorola 6800. And real quick, this is not to be mistaken for the 68000, which is their 16-bit processor. Different episode. The 6800 had its offshoot, which was the NEC, 6502. And that was a slightly stripped down, but more inexpensive processing chip. And that was used by many different things. NEC, not as well known in America, but in Japan, they were responsible for the 8801 and 9801 PCs, which were some of the most prevalent PCs in Japan in the 80s. And so that's why NEC is a notable name. And somehow in this whole game, Ricoh, R-I-C-O-H, makes an offshoot of the 6502 that is patented with Nintendo to do this 6502 processor. And that's the processor that runs the Famicom / NES. Now, that processor is basically a Motorola 6800. What it can do, all kinds of stuff. And really to break down how the NES works and how it uses these processors to make things on the screen is that it could handle 8-bit operations. And it did have something that we should mention just because it'll come up at the end of the show when I talk about mappers. Well, maybe I'll just talk about mappers now. But it had a memory map. So it had a place where it would predefine items in memory. And when it predefined these items in memory, it would place them in like a table. And it could use these as reference points as it worked throughout the program and had to do various operations. And an easy way of thinking about this is, you know, when it had to like draw new parts of the screen as you move forward and backwards in Castlevania, or when it had to detect in Castlevania when, you know, Simon Belmont's whip hit something and it had to be destroyed, or even when Mario jumps on a Goomba, right? These are all, or even Mario's current state, whether he's standing still or running, these are all things the operation has to do. And then the video chip, so the NES had an 8-bit PPU, it was a custom video chip for Nintendo, that had its own limitations. And so the easy way to think about it is you've got a background layer, and the background layer drew more than what you saw on the screen. And then you've got tiles, and these tiles were how you made the background and the sprites. And just thinking about modern day stuff, most people can understand two layers. You've got a background layer and a sprite layer. You can do far more in the background, far more pixels, shall we say, but maybe not far more dynamic visuals. And then the sprites can do their own thing. But you have a sprite limit. There can only be a certain number of sprites. I think it was 4 per scan line on the NES. And anytime you would do more than that, you'd get the lovely flicker effect. And anytime the processor couldn't keep up with all the things that you were trying to make it do in the operations, you would get the illustrious slowdown that we're very familiar with in the 8-bit and 16-bit era. And so Nintendo did have one limitation, or some of the limitations of it, and everything involving 8-bit consoles is about limitations and working around them. And so Nintendo could create everything in 8x8 pixel tiles, and they were limited to only 4 colors per tile. And so how that relates to what you can get in your overall image is you have a total palette of 52 colors, but you're only able to display 25 colors simultaneously. And one thing it can do that's kind of clever is it can do something called sprite swapping. So when you think about the CRT, right, the it's drawing its lines, and we'll get to this with video, you know, people don't realize how aware developers were of where the line, the scan line is in its process of drawing the image from top to bottom. Because like modern day TVs just draw the image as one. You just get one. It's like a frame buffer. Like you just get one image and it just displays, you know, 30, 60, 120 times a second. Back in these days, no, the line's just going at a frequent pace, right? And you have to know where the line is and draw about it. And if you've ever read Racing the Beam, or if you haven't, that's all about Ed Freeze, talking about how that was first noted in Atari, where they're always trying to be cognizant of where the scan line is, where the CRT gun is at in drawing the lines so they can do stuff. Because if you look at a full image, you can see where, like in many video games we loved growing up, like the bottom part of the screen is corrupted, but see, it hasn't gotten to the point of drawing that part. And so it does a lot of cool stuff at the top half of the screen and then rushes back to the bottom half to redraw it so it doesn't look all corrupted when it's created. So it's very clever and cool. All of the really high speed stuff going on to make the simplest things, such as like the top of Super Mario Brothers, display the timer and how many coins you have, or later on in Mario 3, displaying all of those like status elements, such as how fast Mario's running and, you know, how many coins he's got, all that stuff. That's all, sorry, I keep bouncing my desk as I throw my arms around because I'm very excited about this stuff. You can tell, and I've probably had too much coffee this morning, but it's these are all these things that this system is trying to do. So while we may look at the NES and say, well, that's not very cool, to me, when you start looking behind the curtain at what it's doing, I think it is very cool. And so, but that is how kind of 8-bit works and where we get into how all these operations work. And I'm going to get into the Master System and the PC Engine in a moment, TurboGrafx-16, sorry. But I want to take a sidestep to talk a little bit about, so let's talk about programming languages. So many people are probably aware that console games, and just in case you're not aware, most of your arcade games, your PC games, sorry, microcomputer games, everything from like Apple II, Commodore 64, yes, even your ZX Spectrum and things like that, and your console games, up and until, I want to say, maybe it's PlayStation, but again, I haven't done enough research to speak to it, is largely done in assembly language. And what assembly language is a commonly readable it's a readable version to humans, to us, to people programming, to programmers, of machine language. Now, machine language is really the basis of how microprocessors understand. It is, and I don't even know if it's a language as much as it's just machine code. It's code. It's how processors understand. Even as I understand it nowadays, and lots of YouTubers out there to thank for that one. I don't have a specific one, but I'll mention some other people soon. But yeah, machine language code is how processors understand everything. And so no matter how you program something, no matter what language you use, it needs to end up in machine. And the more complex that conversion is, the slower your game runs. And to that end, everything that's on consoles, in order to make them even remotely viable, was done in assembly because it's the easiest conversion straight to machine. Like, it takes almost no time to convert it. And if you write in assembly, it's something that a programmer can at least understand. And it's complicated, and it was used more for, like, I understand, like, automotive lines in like the 70s or something. But this, and again, the version of assembly you use is chip dependent. So when you're writing an NES game, you have to write it for the Ricoh 6502 processor. And this is the language they used, because if you use something like, most of your microcomputer fans out there will know BASIC. BASIC struggled to run at even close to the same speed as assembly / machine. And a big shout out there to the 8-bit guy who kind of has a great, that's his YouTube. He has a great way of just kind of showing this off. He shows you something he programmed in BASIC, and then he shows you how he can optimize that. And then he does it in assembly, and you can see it just does way faster. And so basically you couldn't program in BASIC, even though it was probably easier, because the NES just couldn't run it that fast. And that's why you see with a lot of microcomputer games, that can be one reason why you see with a lot of microcomputer games that, like, scrolling and things like that don't work as well, because maybe they programmed it in BASIC or they didn't optimize it well enough. Again, we get back to that root where the programmer really decides how versatile the system is. And so that's kind of how that works. And you go even further with, like, C. Like, I'm forgetting who wrote it, but the guy who wrote Marble Madness, it might have even been Mark Cerny. I think it was Mark Cerny, actually, who programmed Marble Madness. He programmed that in C. And that's why it's one of the first arcade games that runs at 30 frames per second and not 60. They just didn't have the hardware to get it to run any faster. And again, that's for the arcade conversion. I'm not talking about Marble Madness on the NES. That was obviously written in assembly and highly compromised. And that is the whole trick, right? That is something that will become a central theme when I talk about stuff, both on my YouTube channel and here, is, you know, nowadays, everything is just quote unquote like a port. Like you take this base concept and you make little tweaks so that it can work on, say, an Xbox Series X and a PC and a PlayStation 5. But back in the day, it was like, oh, well, we know there's no way we can do this. So how do we strip away everything non-essential to get this, you know, compromised, or I think compromise is the best way to look at it. This is a compromised version where you get the experience, but we know you can't recreate anywhere near the arcade experience or even the main experience, right? This is when you port things one to another. If you port something from the SNES to the NES, right, you just have to strip things away and get as close as you can to the experience. And anyone who played games growing up in these worlds will tell you there are varying degrees of success and failure. Anyway, so that is what assembly is. That is how it works. By and large, when you look at assembly, it is literally just hexadecimal stuff. So there's 255 characters. It's ones, zeros, letters, and symbols. And you just have these in two, I think they are always two character combinations, and then each row has, I believe, eight combinations. That may be the 8-bit part of it. But again, I'm getting into territory that I probably shouldn't go, unforeseen waters. So let's circle back and talk about how the NES compares to the Master System, slash the Mark III as it's known in Japan, and the TurboGrafx-16 or PC Engine as it's known in Japan. This will be way quicker than you'd think. So many people have heard that the Mark III or Master System is stronger than the NES. Technically, that's true, but anybody who compares one-to-one NES games and Master System games will find that that doesn't really get put to use most of the time. Sure, Phantasy Star is incredibly impressive, and you have the likes of programmer Yuji Naka, who would later go on to program the physics engine for Sonic the Hedgehog. Yeah, he managed to make a 60 frames per second first-person dungeon view for dungeon crawling in Phantasy Star. That's incredible. But for every one of those, you get like closer stuff like Double Dragon. Double Dragon on the NES and the Master System look very similar to one another, regardless of the Master System's visual capabilities being upgraded. And then you even go a step back. One of my favorite examples is I love Space Harrier, and Space Harrier is on the Master System, and it doesn't look or run great. Meanwhile, you have Square doing its version of Space Harrier, which is 3D World Runner on the NES, and it looks runs markedly better. And so these are simple examples, but then we get into the subjective nature of it. Maybe you think Double Dragon doesn't look so comparable. Maybe you think it looks way better. Maybe you think Space Harrier is significantly better on the Master System than that stupid 3D World Runner in the NES. I can't do anything about the subjective nature of it. And that's why there's no point in talking about it unless we're doing a show like that, which I might do someday. But at its core, the biggest differences with the Master System versus the NES is, first of all, the Master System is using the Z80 processor, and it has a VDP, so its graphics processor, is actually capable of both 8-bit and 16-bit instructions. So it's like a hybrid where you have an 8-bit processor for doing whatever you want to do in the console, and then a 16-bit processor for creating the images. And the way that can help itself a little bit is that you've got the ability to have, so for example, the Master System can have more colors on the screen. It has a palette of 64 versus Nintendo's 52, and on the screen it can have up to 32 colors versus Nintendo's 25. Does that make for that big of a deal? It can. It can if you put the time into it. Another interesting thing about the Master System versus the NES is that the Master System was capable of doing more with its tiles. It was capable of 8 colors per tile as opposed to, for its 8x8 tiles, as opposed to the NES's four colors, which kind of explains, you know, the larger color items. The other thing is it couldn't do sprite swapping like the NES could, but it could do background swapping. So it could swap its tiles in the background. The NES couldn't do that. So what you can get in the end is more detailed backgrounds where your sprites are doing its own thing, but the backgrounds make up more of what you see on the screen. So you could do more clever things with that. In my experience looking at it, not enough developers took advantage of it to really go, oh my goodness, NES is nothing compared to the Master System. And frankly, like we see time and time again, things just progress. As the NES continues to live on in America, we see development improve. Same thing with the Master System as the Game Gear becomes a similar peripheral. And especially in Europe, they ported a lot of Game Gear games over to the Master System. So then wrapping up, let's look at the TurboGrafx-16, otherwise known as the PC Engine in Japan. So the way this works is it uses the same concept of the Master System, where it has a 8-bit processor and a 16-bit graphics processor, but now these are customized. So the processor that's run is a custom NEC chip that was supervised by Hudson, because behind everything the TurboGrafx did was the developer and publisher Hudson. And Hudson made its name doing a lot of Famicom games. And then my understanding was they wanted to team up with Nintendo on stuff, and you'll hear about items like this in the future. Nintendo didn't agree to the deal. They wanted to still be in charge of everything. So Hudson works with NEC, branches out on its own, makes its own console. That really is how the PC Engine comes into play. And I think NEC equally wanted to do some sort of conversion of making its own version of bringing its very popular PC 8898 line to console gaming. And so what that special 8-bit chip is, though, is really just a modified version of the Ricoh 6502. It runs a lot faster, it has more capabilities, but at its core, it's still running like a Nintendo. And that's why you do see a lot of games ported from the NES over to the PC Engine or TurboGrafx, depending on if it came to America or not. And looking, they look way better, but they play very similar. And it's that graphics chip that, while the Master System did have a 16-bit graphics processor, it didn't make strong use of it, whereas the TurboGrafx is given a lot of extra RAM and various other capabilities, hardware capabilities, that allowed it to take much bigger use of it. And so you can see bigger sprites, larger backgrounds, and definitely more colors. The TurboGrafx could do 64 colors on the screen at the same time, I believe. And I know it was capable of 512 total colors, which is equal to the palette of, again, different episode, different conversation, of the Sega Genesis / Mega Drive, which was a 16-bit console through and through. So that is kind of how the 8-bit generation worked and what kind of made for it. Now, I want to talk real quick about something called mapper chips, because if you talk about the NES, you will inevitably hear about mapper chips and what are those. And mapper chips were basically the way that cartridges could expand on the capabilities of the Famicom or NES. Out of the box, the NES is extremely prohibited on what it can do. And a lot of people say that Super Mario Brothers was about the best you could do with an out-of-the-box NES. But they could have extra chips on there that allowed you to expand the capabilities of the NES. An easy example was Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. You'll notice that the enemies in Mike Tyson's Punch-Out are massive sprites. How were they able to do that? And that's because they were able to use more memory areas. And I believe this is where my technicalities kind of fall off, but they can take 30, so I think it was 32 KB was the RAM that the NES could use at any one given time. And so in order to use more than one 32-bit cluster at the exact same time, you had to have these mapper chips which could jump between the different clusters on the fly. And I believe this was called bank switching, but again, what the mapper chips are doing is just creating more repositories for things to reside. And then bank switching is the way that it can bounce back and forth between those things on the fly in the cartridge. And I think you have to have your main zero bank always be in use in some way, but then it can switch over to the other ones. And anyway, it's how you get all kinds of stuff to work in, like, it actually, right off the bat, it's how they were able to take Famicom Disk System games, which would expand the storage space of the NES beyond the average cartridge, but you would have load times, because every time it had to switch into a new program, you'd get a quick loading screen. Well, bank switching allowed cartridges to do the same, and not to explain this very well, go to the Displaced Gamer's YouTube page if you want to see how that is explained. He does an incredible job of kind of formulating how things went from the Famicom Disk System over to the NES, and also bank switching and mapper chips and all that stuff. But those are the ways that the NES was able to kind of expand its capabilities. And I know that the Sega Master System did not use pre-set up like maps for the storage of places, like pre-set addresses. And that actually slowed down some of the capabilities of the system when it needed to go find these items. But it had stuff like interrupts and whatnot that could everything is just about taking the limitations and figuring out ways around it so that you don't have a problem. And from the end user perspective, I think the Master System and the NES are very comparable. With the TurboGrafx, you just see much bigger, brighter, colorful sprites on screen, but when you really look down to what the game's doing, it's not very different from NES, and that's why you'll see stuff like, you'll see parity between the two. Ninja Gaiden is on the NES and the TurboGrafx, and other than visual differences, they run very similar to one another. The same is true in the reverse direction. The exclusive Bonk's Adventure, well, conceivably exclusive on the TurboGrafx-16/PC Engine, actually ports itself over to the NES late in the NES lifecycle. And again, it runs the same game, it just looks very different because of its visual limitations. So last but not least, let's get into visuals, because I think that's the last thing that really defines the 8-bit generation. And let's talk about 240p. This is a fun buzzword. So let's first and foremost just get into broadcast systems. So you have different broadcast systems. By and large, Japan uses a modified version of NTSC, but NTSC, and I won't look into what the acronyms are because I haven't memorized them. And again, Displaced Gamers gets into this a little bit more, but basically you've got NTSC in North America and Japan, and then you've got PAL in Europe and in Australia. And that's kind of how it worked from a video game console perspective. And the way this originally worked was that you would have black and white televisions. And so the only thing you would have to send in your video signal was the image and then what is called a luma signal, or a black and white. It's the different shades of gray that exist to make up an image. And then when they decided to go to color, that's where you've got the chroma signal or the color signal. They wanted to make sure it was backward compatible. Believe it or not, broadcast had thought about this. And so what they did there was they made it so that you'll still get the luma signal, but you will then be able to fill in more gaps of the color through the chroma signal. And that meant that if you introduced, let's say, an NES or a broadcast system that had color in it, and you had just a black and white TV, it could just read off that luma signal and still be able to create an image, which is kind of cool, in my opinion. And so there is a drastic difference between the two when you think about things like timing of where the scan line is on the page, resolution, and more importantly, frame rate. Because frame rate is something you can't easily adapt and never has been well adapted. The ideal is you take the base frame rate and you stick to it. So in North America, in NTSC, North America, Asia, you have an image that is technically considered 480 interlaced. So there's 525 lines, but 480 is visible on the screen. And so what happens in those other parts is where different parts of the code and whatnot could reside. And so that is why when you look at the NES on a CRT TV, it just looks like an NES. But then when you put it into like an emulator or something, which can show the full 525 lines, or 480 lines, because really all that was visible on the screen was 224 lines duplicated up, which is less than 480. I'm not going to do the math off the top of my head. It's like 460 or something. But anyway, it's 448, 224. Anyway, and then in PAL territories, you had 625 lines. And when those got scanned down, it was, 525. Yeah. And so that's where you've got what actually exists in the image versus what you can see on the screen. And they accounted for that. There is also areas on the left and right side of the screen where it's cropped in as well. And so this is where different graphical anomalies, glitches, not really glitches, things that needed to exist in the code, either from a video signal standpoint or from a programming standpoint that they knew wouldn't be visible on a CRT TV, that they kind of like hid in what you can't see. And when you put it into an emulator, you can see it. So to make it easier, you've got 480i and 525i, which means interlaced, which meant as it, and everything's a bandwidth issue. Everything in the whole crux of technology is bandwidth. What can you do with the container you're given? And so all they could do was the television refreshed at 60 frames a second, but all they could do with their bandwidth was fill in half the frames. So every half of a second, they would fill in half of the frames and then come back over and fill in the other half of the frame for the other 30. And then combined, you get an image that is actually moving between like evens and odd lines. But to the naked eye, it is showing motion, and you are refreshing technically at 60 frames a second, but your image is only refreshing at 30 frames a second because it needs 30 frames to fill in the evens and 30 frames to fill in the odds. Okay, so that's how resolution works. And so really every 30 frames you were filling in, you know, 240 lines on NTSC and what is 288 lines on PAL. And PAL does not work evenly with the 525. So yeah, you've got that going on. And your end result, and PAL refreshed every 50 times a second. That was just part of their broadcast standard. So you've got America refreshing more often at a lower resolution, and Europe and Australia refreshing less often with a higher resolution. And again, everyone can understand that concept with modern day bandwidth and whatnot. And so how video game consoles took advantage of this to actually give a progressive, so it refreshes every image 60 times a second, is that it would actually do, Nintendo called it double strike, but it would be what we call 240p, which is it would only fill in either the evens or the odds, I forget which one it was, but it would only fill in half the lines. And then when it went to do its second round of 30 in the same second, it would refill those same lines. So then you've got a refreshment of 60 frames per second, as opposed to your 30 frames bouncing back and forth to odd and even. Since today we do progressive across the board, it's kind of a retroactive definition that we call it 240p. It was just inherently how things worked with retro consoles, which is why there were always scan lines, and it's why retro enthusiasts like scan lines, because the consoles were refreshing faster than television, faster than broadcast at 60 frames a second, but it was because it just never filled in the second half and reused it over and over again. So it kind of tricked the TV into filling in the same spot, so it was refreshing twice as fast. So where that comes in is, so it's 240p for North America, Japanese, and then when you go to Europe and Australia, you get 288p, or you know, 525, which was for the 525. And so that's all that means. It just means that you're getting 60 frames a second, but when you're putting it on modern TVs and you're trying to scale things up, you've got half the resolution to work with. It was really just 240 lines, and realistically with all these consoles, it's only 224 lines of resolution. So when you're trying to branch that up into like 1080p, or where it was easier, integer scaled to 720p, you have to account for not only that reduced resolution, but also those scan lines that filled in the gap. So there are different ways to do it, and I'm not going to get into it in this episode, but that's where 240p comes from. And so how would they spew out these images, and the resolution can be different, but by and large, you're looking at like 256 by 224. But I think the NES, and this is how like smooth scrolling happens, the NES and the Master System and the TurboGrafx would, the background layer could be much larger. So it's just moving in an XYZ plane among this predetermined background system. And then it would redraw parts of the background as it needed it, which is how you kind of achieved smooth scaling on these consoles. And so when you've got these signals, you've got to send them to the TV, and there are many ways to do it. There's RF, which is the screw-in connection. Everybody knows that, radio frequency, and all of these consoles were capable of it. RF was the standard, honestly, when I was a kid growing up. Every one of my TVs had screw-on connections. The other connections that were available, RCA created these. So they were sometimes called RCA jacks, but they're better known these days as composite video. Those started to hit with more modern sets. I think they started as early as the late 80s. I haven't looked into this, but I definitely know that by like the early to mid 90s, I saw them in the back of TV sets when I would get like a new TV, when I would buy my own TV as opposed, you know, with some birthday money or something, as opposed to inheriting whatever set my family had laying around the house that I played my NES on. And those plugs did exist for certain consoles. So the Famicom didn't have them until later on. They made the AV Famicom in Japan, which was their version of what we got as the NES 101, which is the top loader NES in the early 90s. That one did have AV ports out, but the NES in America, and I believe in Europe as well, always had AV ports out where you could hook up through composite video. It was only mono, so you had a yellow and a red, but for those that are not familiar with composite or don't really know it by those terms, it was a yellow composite video signal. It was, and then it was the stereo sound, the white and the red for left and right. And that's what made it up. In the Master System, they had a AV multi-out port that was capable of composite video as well as RGB, which I'll get to in a minute. And that did have stereo sound from the get. So I think it was because of the Yamaha synth chip that was only in Japanese Master Systems, as I understand it, the Mark III's. But because of that architecture, even though they used a different sound chip in the Western releases, it was still capable of stereo sound. Now, what's interesting is the TurboGrafx is capable of higher fidelity graphics and higher, you know, stereo sound, and yet they chose to only do RF out. This is this weird gap in the understanding of I would think, NEC and Hudson when they're making this decision. So you only had that screw-on connection. And the same was true of the TurboGrafx 16, which only had an RF out. But that, unlike the NES, which had a couple of years in Japan before things would come out in America, I think the same was true of the Master System. You really see, after the PC Engine comes out, the TurboGrafx comes pretty hot on its heels into North America, and the same is true of the CD console, which I'll get into with my, you know, PC Engine CD expose. And so I think they just didn't think about it. Fortunately, there was a huge 20-pin expansion port on the back of both the PC Engine and the TurboGrafx 16 that did allow you to either buy a composite out add-on. I think it was $30, and you could plug it into the back and it would give you composite video out, or it was built in if you bought the CD add-on. It just naturally had composite video out because it took over the back area, including where the RF cable was. So that was how they achieved it. And composite video was better than RF in that it had a higher quality. I don't think it had a higher bandwidth, but I could be wrong about that. And it was a direct connection, right? So if something, there were a lot of radio waves, probably far less than today though, passing through the air. And so those could disturb things. So like your mom runs the microwave and all of a sudden your TV looks wonky. RCA ideally prevented that because it had shielding and it was a direct connection. Last but not least, and this was more prevalent in, to a certain extent, Japan and definitely in Europe, was RGB. So it was the actual red, green, and blue signals that the TV used to make up a color stream, exported directly to the TV. And most of the plugins for that was SCART. And they look interesting. You probably haven't seen them in America unless you're a retro enthusiast. They kind of have weird teeth and everything like that. It's 21 pins. Kind of looks like a big old grill version, like a, the front of like a Dodge Ram version of an HDMI port. And this port is on like basically every European TV and a certain number, maybe a decent number of Japanese TVs. But they are different. The pinouts are different. So SCART in Europe, EuroSCART, as it's called, is different from JSCART, which is Japan SCART. So they're not interchangeable. Obviously, different broadcasts. It's also important to note that SCART is just a delivery mechanism for video signals. SCART can carry composite video, RGB video, S video, and I think it might even be able to carry component video, which means depending on what's built into the cable, you have certain capabilities. So just because you have a SCART cable doesn't mean it can do RGB. But assuming you did, you were able to get RGB out of the master system just right off the bat. It would use the composite signal for sync. You always need a sync signal when you're trying to sync up Luma and Chroma for your video signal. But that's how it achieved it. I think in America, you have to do a modification with the master system to make it get the sync signal and make it compatible with TVs. Plus, you have to figure out a way to make SCART work on American TVs. There's different converters and stuff, but there's ways. With the PC Engine, there wasn't really a way to get RGB. There were modifications people could do, and nowadays there's a lot of adapters that can do it. But it wasn't out back then. NEC never thought about it. Hudson and NEC never released something for it. And RGB was not a common way to get a video signal back then. And even now we're seeing a resurgence where RGB is the cleanest. If you look at My Life in Gaming, they talk a lot about sync signals and RGB SCART and how to get RGB out of old TVs and convert them to modern either HD or CRTs in America. Their channel is incredible for that information, way more than I can offer here. But in the end, I'm starting to see this resurgence where a lot of people are saying, well, but what I really remember was the composite signal. And a lot of developers have come out and said, we programmed with the composite blur and the color bleed and all those things that aren't very sharp as part of what made up the image. And so there's a lot of, you know, there's no right answer out there. And that's kind of my push on the soapbox from the Dead Space episode. But there's a lot of arguments out there for people saying, well, I like it really sharp. Oh, I like to see what I saw as a kid. And so the answer is there is no right or wrong answer. It's more expensive to dabble in RGB and various other forms of out or HDMI out than it is to just take the native composite. But there's no wrong answer. Personally, I like getting the RGB signal, converting it to component video, which is something we use in our country, in America, way more widely, which was red, green, and blue ports for the video, and then red and white for the audio. This was like the highest end of standard definition that we got in this country, and then it was early versions of high definition. We went to 720p and 1080i. And even to a certain extent, 1080p, because component can carry the whole 1080p signal. But these were in TVs for a short period of time on CRT, and then they were prevalent in early HD TVs. And this video works a little different than RGB. What it actually does is it takes the Luma signal, which is green, and then it does the change in red and the change in blue to deduce all of the color signals, and then it's got stereo out. And then there was an earlier version of that, which was S-video, and all that did was where composite combined both Chroma and Luma into the same thing. S-Video instead took four prongs and gave out Luma as one signal, Chroma as another signal, and your stereo sound. And that's why you've got your little four little prongs on your rounded S-Video. So there you go. That's what those ports stand for. But again, in the end, there's no wrong answer. Whether you want to play on a CRT TV or an HD TV, whether you want to play with composite video, S-Video, component video, SCART, RGB, HDMI, who cares as long as you can make those things modify. And if input lag is a problem, you can adjust for that. But like so many other things, trying to get these things to work just so, as like my life in gaming clearly points out, can be very expensive and a timely endeavor. Whereas maybe it's just more nostalgic, more fun, and easier to just hook your NES up with composite cables to a CRT TV, or just getting a HDMI version or an emulator and just playing it on a TV. Like I said before, you do you. But that's how all those signals work. And that is why you have to be really cognizant, especially when updating to HD TVs or modifying European systems to work in America or vice versa. You have to be very aware of the different frame rates they use and how you've got to adapt that signal. And so there's a lot of things to be accounted for when you dig into it. And that's why those things exist. So anyway, that's it for the tech situation. I hope I helped demystify a little bit of it without getting too technical and kind of explained how these old consoles worked, especially in the late 80s, from the 8-bit perspective. So with that, we're going to move on to just wrapping up. So no real news things. I'm hoping to next week have my first expose of the PC Engine CD. Think about it as technically kind of a version of Cron CD episode one. It's going to cover the release of the PC Engine CD and kind of some of the things. There's not going to be a whole lot of overlap with this, but some of the things you need to consider with that system. And it's going to focus on the launch in Japan in late December. It is December 1988. And then the conversion into 1989 in both Japan and the release of the TurboGrafx CD in America in 1989 and kind of what comes out. And it's going to focus on pretty much 1989 and what you need to consider. And it is going to go over all the games. I hope to have that out soon. I've recorded most of it, but the editing is taking a long time because I think you can kind of tell even with this where I don't edit too much or listening to my other podcasts. I don't know whether it's that I'm 40 or what. The information's all in there, but the processor's taking a little longer to hit it and kick it out. So I got to edit out a lot of ums and ups. And sometimes when I go off on bunny trails, I want to edit that out. So I try to make a more cohesive episode for you. Also, just so you know what I'm kind of planning on in the interim, you may see this before or after that episode, is GoldenEye. I had never played GoldenEye on the N64. I think I dabbled with it and definitely played the multiplayer. But now that these other versions came out, I kind of went back to the N64 version and played the Switch version, and which is very similar, and then played the Xbox version, and I have played the 360 version as well. I just wanted to talk about that a little bit and kind of my thoughts on GoldenEye moving forward. Again, I don't know if that's going to be a full hour, but this one ended up coming in without planning, just right around an hour, so maybe that's just how I work. Finally, we can get to the soapbox, and this week, I'm actually hinting on something that's very GoldenEye-esque, but I am playing the Dead Space remake, so to bring it back to last episode, as well as, you know, GoldenEye and various others, and there's both remakes and remasters, but I'm specifically talking about, and with like Metroid Prime remake being announced, there's a lot of remaking being done. And as a retro gamer, I'm finding that perhaps if you played something in the past, you might just be good without them. That doesn't mean to not go with remakes and stuff. I think it's always great when these remakes come out and introduce to a new audience a classic game. And I know some people may scoff at thinking of things like Metroid Prime or even Dead Space, especially Dead Space, as being a classic game. But Dead Space can be hard to go back to if you are in your teens or 20s now, especially those in their 20s, because I guess Dead Space is technically not for teenagers, but I know a lot of them are playing it. And so if remastered is, or this remake is the way for them to get back to it, great. But you do get kind of lost in the mix where I'm finding maybe I don't enjoy it as much as, say, modern gamers do. And I think a lot of reviewers that are my age might just be happy that part of their job, they get to go revisit this this game or never experienced it in the past and get to go back and see what it was all about playing this newer version. And that's fine too. But I'm not in a, you know, with my experience with Dead Space and then even to a certain extent with GoldenEye, I'm not in quite a hurry to jump at it. And so I will not be jumping at Metroid Prime Remastered right off the bat. And I've never played Metroid Prime, so I think I'm going to go back and play. I've heard it's really rough to get into on the GameCube, and I've played like an hour on the GameCube and didn't love it. So maybe I'll go back and play that Wii U port of the Wii Trilogy bundle, and I'll just play the first one for right now. But I guess what I would say is, if you're a retro game person, maybe you don't need to jump on board with these remasters, especially, or remakes, especially if you played them in the past. I think the only exception I can think of right now is Resident Evil has shown a great ability to time and time again be able to handle remakes properly, Capcom, sorry, with the Resident Evil franchise with Remake 1, 2, and 3. And I think only time will tell if 4 can close that gap as well. I will definitely be jumping on day one because of that. But by and large, as a general rule, maybe I don't need to go back into those remasters if I already played the vanilla game. Anyway, with that, this is Fred Rojas saying, see you next week.